Hello there. Today is Friday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a long, intense week of impeachment inquiry testimony wraps up. We'll have analysis on where things stand as both sides claim victory.
The facts are on our side. The facts are on the president's side. The truth is on the president's side.
Israel's prime minister is indicted on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Also ahead, a proposed rule that could be a barrier to thousands of children being adopted. It's all on today's International Edition. A former White House official said Thursday that President Donald Trump's top European envoy was sent on a domestic political errand, seeking investigations of Democrats' stunning testimony that dismantled a main line of the president's defense in the impeachment inquiry. In a riveting appearance on Capitol Hill, British-born Fiona Hill, the Russian scholar who served on the National Security Council Thursday, implored Republican lawmakers and Trump himself to stop peddling baseless suggestions that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election to bolster Russia, as it seems to sow political divisions in the United States.
Some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves.
In closing remarks, the hearing ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, said the impeachment hearings were designed to produce a storyline.
What you've seen in this room over the past 2 weeks is a show trial. The planned result of 3 years of political operations and dirty tricks. Campaigns waged against this president.
Well, Fiona Hill had a front row seat of some of Trump's pursuits with Ukraine during her tenure at the White House. Her testimony, as well as from David Holmes, a State Department advisor in Kiev, capped an intense week in the historic inquiry and reinforced the central complaint that Trump used his leverage over Ukraine, a young Eastern European democracy facing Russian aggression, to pursue political investigations. His alleged actions set off alarms across the U.S. national security and foreign policy apparatus. And in his closing arguments, House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff said Republicans' argument that the witnesses all presented hearsay when it comes to quid pro quo just does not hold water.
We don't have to consider that you have direct evidence that this meeting in the White House was being withheld because the president wanted these meetings, these investigations. We can't accept that. Well, if that were true, you could never present any evidence in court.
Well, joining us now to talk more about this last public hearing of the week, and possibly for good, we just don't know at this point in this investigation, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, thanks so much for being with us as always. What did you think of Thursday's testimony?
It was impressive because what we found was a very big picture look at why it is that Ukraine is so important to the United States. Not a question of Ukraine, it's a question of the U.S. And so what we found was both David Holmes, again, senior staffer with the State Department, and Fiona Hill with the Pentagon, really articulating why this is such a big deal to the United States. I mean, they talked about some of the specifics and why this was critically important and what happened, but they spent a lot of time talking about why we should care.
What was their explanation?
The biggest reason is the U.S. is fundamentally involved in what's happened with the former Soviet Union. And when we've reached into the likes of Ukraine, Georgia, Azerbaijan, other places like that, what we're trying to do is create stability and to deal with the problems that come with the blowing apart of the Soviet Union. So this is something we've been working on for decades. And in particular, Ukraine plays this unique role in the world, and the U.S. desperately wants to see stability and competency in the region. And so we've spent enormous resources, and we focused on this. And what Fiona Hill said was that the Russians are the ones who went after the United States. It was not Ukraine. And in fact, what some on the committee is doing, and she was really pointing at the Republicans and saying, your argument that this was the Ukrainians or the Ukrainians too is exactly what the Russians want you to say, because not them, it's the Russians. And it's always been the Russians. What David Holmes really talked about was being an expert on this area. He was talking about how desperate the Ukrainians were. And in the end, they were willing to do just about anything for the Americans in this case. So he dovetailed what Sondland had talked about with the president alongside just how desperate the Ukrainians were to actually do what the Americans wanted, and even setting a timeline, talking way back in July, how early the Ukrainians became aware of funding being stopped.
It did appear throughout the hearing that Republicans were really digging into their stance from the beginning, that this was all just a sideshow, basically, this whole impeachment hearing, that this is just something that the Democrats wanted because they were disappointed that the president got elected in the first place and that they wanted this from the beginning. Did it really make any difference if they had already made their decision before the hearings even began and never really faltered from that?
Impeachment is a political process. It's not a criminal process. And in the end, the real purpose was to convince enough people to really understand what the president did and why it matters so much. The expectation here is that the Republicans, being advocates for the president, were going to vote the way they were going to vote for him anyway. But I think what the Dems were really trying to accomplish was convince the American people that this is not just a problem, but this is absolutely a critical issue for the United States, and what this president did is something that no sitting president can ever do, and that the American people themselves would start pushing on the Senate to vote the way they believe they should vote.
Now, the Senate is controlled by Republicans. It has a majority of Republicans, and all indications are that if the Democrats decide to actually file articles of impeachment and then it goes into a trial in the Senate, there's no indication that there will be even close to enough votes from the Republicans in the Senate to do anything to convict, basically, which would mean to remove the president. So what do you expect to see going forward?
The U.S. Constitution requires a two-thirds majority to remove a president. Based upon the numbers that we're seeing right now, it's unlikely, to almost impossible, that you're going to see that. It simply will not happen. At the same time, I think it was critical that this be done for the people of the United States. This is not a Democrat or a Republican question. This is a question of presidential power and a president misusing that power for his own benefit over the benefit of the United States. And that's what this is always about, and what this should always have been about in the first place. Because in the end, this is something that can't happen in the future. What's critically important is that if we accept the precedent that any sitting president can go out to any foreign government, any foreign intelligence service, and essentially weaponize them to go after that president's domestic rivals, we have fundamentally altered the concept of what the Constitution is trying to do. And I think what the Democrats are trying to establish right now is exactly what this president did. And by the way, based upon all the evidence that I've seen over the last 2 weeks, that is exactly what this president did. What the Democrats are trying to do is convince the Republicans to agree that this is something that can't happen, or that they just don't care. It's astounding because it's not just about one of them saying something. It's about all of them, some coming from the White House, some coming from the Department of Defense, some coming from the State Department, some were politicals like Sondland, all of them coming together and providing this chorus of really bad, purposeful behavior by the president, who decided to put himself in front of the United States of America. And that's really what this is about.
All right. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, we always appreciate your perspective. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. President Donald Trump has thanked Pakistani and Afghan leaders for the release of Western hostages. The Pentagon is rejecting a report that the U.S. is pulling forces from South Korea. A court has postponed a hearing for the eighth time for a Tanzanian journalist. And a new study finds that most adolescents do not exercise enough to stay healthy. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. We get more now from VOA's Latika Hulk.
The embattled prime minister was defiant after Israel's attorney general announced the indictment Thursday.
This evening, we are witnessing an attempted coup against the prime minister with false charges and a contaminated and tendentious investigation process.
Netanyahu has been indicted on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in three long-running corruption cases. He is seeking to convince his supporters that the country's entire political system is affected by corruption and political bias.
I think you need to be blind in order not to see that something wrong is going on among the police investigators and the prosecution.
Netanyahu's supporters came out to protest the charges following the announcement.
I came to tell Netanyahu, you will never march alone. And I came to say that all of the fabricators of this ridiculous and abominable coup attempt won't succeed, simply won't succeed.
But many Israelis say it is time for Netanyahu to resign.
It is unheard of, it is unthinkable that the prime minister will continue in office while being indicted for such grave breaches of law. He will stand trial, he will probably also go to jail. He cannot manage a country as difficult to manage as the state of Israel.
The longest serving prime minister in Israel's history, Netanyahu has been unable to form a ruling coalition after two back-to-back elections this year. His indictment adds to the concern about the state of the country's leadership.
I am very disappointed that for a whole year we don't have a government. It's disappointing. I don't know what will be. I can't see that another election will lead to results that are very different. It's a little bit of a mess. But we'll see. This is a democracy. Eventually, things have a nature of resolving themselves.
Thursday's announcement further complicates Israel's paralyzed political system, in which neither Netanyahu nor his closest rival, Benny Gantz, has been able to form a government following Israel's second election in September. A third election could be held later this year. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed two bills on Hong Kong that will now make their way to the president for final approval. It's a warning to China about its commitment to human rights amid a crackdown on the city's pro-democracy protests. If President Trump signs the bill into law, it would see a ban of certain exports to Hong Kong. Police horses like tear gas, rubber bullets, and pepper spray. We get more now from Michelle Hennessy.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed two bills on Hong Kong that will now make their way to the president for final approval. It's a warning to China about its commitment to human rights amid a crackdown on the city's pro-democracy protests. If President Trump signs the bills into law, it would see a ban of certain exports to Hong Kong police forces, like tear gas, rubber bullets, and pepper spray. It would also make officials who violate human rights in the city vulnerable to U.S. sanctions.
The White House has indicated Trump will sign the legislation. Passage of the measures is widely viewed as a potential roadblock to a major trade deal between the U.S. and China. The White House is proposing a rule that would prevent federal funding to go to adoption agencies that adopt children to LGBTQ families. Vice President Mike Pence is hailing the proposal, arguing it is a matter of religious freedom. But some argue it could end up hurting children who need it the most. Joining us to talk more about it, Nicole Witt, Executive Director of the Adoption Consultancy. Thanks for being with us. Tell us a little bit about what this proposal is all about.
So what happened was at the end of the Obama administration, that administration put an anti-discrimination rule into place, saying that if those agencies wanted to continue to get federal funding, they had to place with all families who could otherwise legally adopt. And so now the Trump administration is basically rolling that back under the auspices of religious freedom, saying, no, you don't have to place with those families and you'll still get your funding. So when the Obama administration said you have to place with all of these families, what happened was kind of a small group of the faith-based agencies said, you know what, we're not going to place with anybody if you're forcing us to place with those families. So now you have all these children in foster care who don't have avenues for getting placed. So this is the theory. So now the Trump administration is saying, okay, we're not going to force that, so these agencies will place children again and it will help those children. But in reality, the backlog with getting children out of foster care placed into families has never been, you know, a lack of agencies. Mm-hmm. It's been a lack of families, right? Mm-hmm. And LGBTQ families are much more open to adopting than traditional families are. So by not giving them access to these government-funded agencies, you're preventing them from adopting. You're having more kids stuck in foster care.
Right.
You know, and all the research shows that the children do just as well in the LGBTQ families. So the logic of they'd be better off staying in foster care rather than getting placed with a non-traditional family, you know, doesn't hold at all.
So what you're basically, what I'm hearing from you is that it's really not hurting the LGBTQ community so much as it is the being detrimental to children that are looking for homes.
Ultimately, it's hurting the children, right? And in theory, in a diverse, large metropolitan area, it's not going to hurt the LGBTQ families that much because they'll always have another agency they can go to who will work with them. But if you're talking about, you know, maybe more rural or less populated, more homogenous parts of the country, then it really can hurt them too, because there might not be another agency who will place with them. And then that's, you know, really hurting the kids in that part of the country because it's really limiting the families they can get placed with.
Does it matter? Does it change the life of a child? And is there any information to suggest that a child adopted by an LGBTQ or gay or lesbian couple, whatever the status is of a parent that the child is affiliated with, does it impact them growing up? Are there statistics that would make this decision, would validate this decision in some way?
There are a variety of studies out there that show that across all measures, the children adopted into LGBTQ families do just as well across all measures as children placed into traditional families. And as far as I'm aware, there is no data that says the opposite. So by, you know, again, claiming that, oh, they're better off in foster care than with a non-traditional family, there's no data that supports that. But there is data that supports they'd be better off with any loving family.
My understanding of the Vice President, Mike Pence, praised the Trump administration decision to restrict federal funding to adoption agencies that support adoption by LGBTQ.
Right. So there, you know, again, it kind of ties back to the whole religious freedom message or school of thought. And, you know, what they're saying is, well, now those agencies that said that they wouldn't place children, now they're going to place children again. So now you're going to have more agencies who are placing children, so that's better. But, you know, again, the backlog for these over 100,000 children in our country who are in foster care waiting to be adopted is not that there aren't enough agencies, right? It's that there aren't enough willing families. And the LGBTQ families are about 7 times more likely to be interested in adopting than traditional families. So by keeping them out of the mix, you're really limiting the families who are willing to adopt these children. So, you know, again, that line of thinking doesn't really hold up to the data.
What exactly is the adoption consultancy?
So what we do is that I tell people a quick way to get it is that I'm kind of like a wedding planner for adoption, and I guide people step by step through the process. And we work more in private adoption, not in foster adoption, but we help our clients get, you know, activated with several different placing entities so things can go more quickly. We provide a lot of education and resources and support for them throughout the process because it is such an overwhelming process. And we try to make it as stress-free as possible for them and help them to adopt, you know, safely, quickly, legally, and without wasting any money.
All right. Nicole Witt, she is the executive director of the Adoption Consultancy. Thanks so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A rare portrait of the classical music composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart is up for sale later this month at Christie's Auction House in Paris. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the portrait is one of only four done of the composer in his lifetime.
The portrait shows a young Mozart sitting at a harpsichord in a red frock coat and a white wig. He stares out at the viewer as if we have interrupted his playing, with a slight smile and piercing eyes. His face is serene, and his right hand plays a chord on the instrument. The head of the Old Masters Department at Christie's Paris, Astrid Centenaire d'Ultremont, told the Reuters news agency that Italian painter Gian Bettino Signoroli painted the portrait in January of 1770 when Mozart and his father visited Verona. Venetian receiver General Pietro Luggiati ordered the painting just days after seeing Mozart give an organ concert in Verona. A letter from Mozart's father to his mother indicates the portrait was done in only two sittings.
We know exactly when it was painted, so it's back to January 1770, and Mozart is aged 13. He's still a young man traveling to Italy with his father, and it was painted for Pietro Luggiati, who saw Mozart playing music and who just decided he was an amazing and talented musician, and he ordered the portrait.
The viewer can also see the music from which the young composer is performing. Noted musicologist and author Alfred Einstein said the sheet music indicates a molto allegro tempo, and the piece has become known as the Allegro of Verona in G major. Astrid Centenaire d'Ultremont says this portrait is the only place that one can find this music.
And what's very interesting about that portrait is the musical score, because it's actually only known from that portrait. So some musicologists have said it could be the work of Mozart himself, who wrote that when he was young and left it behind to the commissioner.
Centenaire d'Ultremont says the painting, which is part of the collection of the famous French pianist Alfred Cortot, should fetch between $881,000 and $1.32 million.
The estimate is around $800,000 to $1.2 million. And actually, we're hoping it makes a million or so, but it's very difficult to say.
Mozart was born in Salzburg, Austria, in 1756 and died only 35 years later. The Mozart portrait is part of Christie's exceptional sale in Paris on November 27th. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Work is starting on a $2.5 million expansion of a Mississippi Delta museum dedicated to a native son who became a blues legend. A groundbreaking ceremony was held Tuesday for new space at the B.B. King Museum and Delta Interpretive Center in Indianola. The museum opened in 2008 near the area where King grew up. The 15-time Grammy winner died in 2015 and is buried on the museum grounds. 418 square meter addition will house King's tour bus and two of his vehicles, a Rolls Royce Silver Shadow, and a custom painted Chevy El Camino. The museum says other artifacts acquired since his death are being preserved and cataloged, including a guitar given to King by guitarist and inventor Les Paul.
Rock me, baby, honey, rock me slow. Rock me, baby.
You have been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day and a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the barrier that divided democratic Western Europe from the communist East. Speaking in Berlin, Germany, U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Mark Green urged young democracy activists to remember that the victory of democracy was not easy, nor was it inevitable. It required struggle and courage. In the late 1990s, the prospects for democracy in Slovakia were dim, to say the least, said Administrator Green. But young activists made the difference.
Prime Minister Mesiar was engaged in a campaign to shut down NGOs, crush the political opposition, physically abuse journalists, tie the country closer to Russia, and to divert state resources to his friends and family. And yet in 1998, a grassroots coalition of opposition parties and NGOs, powered by young people, they unleashed a wave of popular support that carried that coalition to power and put the country back on the path towards democracy and reform and Western integration.
But democratic reform movements don't belong solely to the people of Europe, stressed Administrator Green. The desire for liberty and democracy is universal, as demonstrated by the people of the Gambia. In 2016, under the leadership of Issa Touré, who is now Gambia's vice president, the nation rose up against the brutal dictatorship of Yahya Jammeh. Dr. Touré helped build a grassroots network across her country, calling for liberty and democracy. Jammeh made it clear he would not tolerate dissent, especially not from a woman. Her leadership carried the opposition to victory. When Jammeh refused to step down, Dr. Touré spoke up publicly and demanded that the people's will be respected, which ultimately it was. The struggle for democracy will never be easy, but it is worth the price. As an American president, Teddy Roosevelt, once said, "Far and away, the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm